the beginning of our 2 years, most likely, together, and also the beginning of your collective quest to call a new religious professional at the end of that time to come and live here and serve among you. All this has led me to contemplate ministry. What do ministers do? Or what are they trying to do at any rate? For me, this whole subject is conscience stirring. It forces me to think about what people like John Dobrar, Dory Somers, and me are supposedly up to. And to consider the standards, Isaiah, Theodore Parker, Olympia Brown, by which our craft is and always should be measured. Old-timers say one should preach on ministry at least twice a year. As your interim minister, I am trying to foster a conversation that asks many questions, none less critical than this one: what is ministry? So I will preach on that question repeatedly. But I must tell you at the start, I always find this incredibly difficult, mostly because ministry is, I think, an almost impossible job. It's often referred to as the second oldest profession. And it must be, because, you know, shamans are there from the beginning almost. And you know, in terms of the first oldest profession, it's clear to me, too, that there are ways in which prostitutes minister, and there are ways in which ministers prostitute ourselves. I think of one of my mentors, Rabbi Jerome Molino in Danbury, Connecticut, where I had my first kind of solo church. And Rabbi Molino was a wonderful person. You'll hear more about him over the years. But the first luncheon together, he said to me, "Now, Steve, if you, in this kind of work, if you're not almost losing your job, you're not doing it." This often leads to problems. There's the story of the young seminary graduate who preached his first sermon on following the teachings of Jesus, and it was great, and everybody loved it. The people on the search committee were commended, and people were just totally jazzed. And then the next week, he preached the identical sermon, and people were a little confused. It was a good sermon, but he was still moving in. There was a lot going on. He just had too much going on. So, sure, that was okay. The third week, he preached the same sermon again. Immediately, the board gathers in executive session, and they have a critical conversation. They come up to him and say, "Now, wait a minute. You know, we want a new sermon every week." He said, "But you haven't followed the first one yet." But trying to get, you know, it can get boring in a way if you're sitting in the pew. I mean, Theodore Parker preached something like 75 sermons in a row on the subject of abolition. Okay. And his members in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, not one of whom owned property and slaves, you know, just began to get, and they talked to him about it. He said, "No, this is too critical. It has to be addressed." And until it is addressed, I cannot preach on anything else. William Ellery Channing's anti-slavery sermons irritated his largest contributors, many of whom made their fortunes in the shipping and textile industries, and some of whom withdrew from the church. The problem, it seems to me, is that there are many implicit contradictions woven right into the fabric of ministry. Success in ministry, it seems to me, is the art and practice of turning these contradictions into creative contrasts. It's like the plus and minus of electricity or teamwork and competition within a company, or the sometimes lead, sometimes follow involved in marriages. That dynamic of not always being the boss, but trading off and being comfortable with following on some places and leading in others. The art in marriage and in ministry is turning it into a dance, creative contrast, instead of a brawl. Well, how does one do this? How to avoid the pitfalls and turn the interactive relationship we call parish ministry into a dance? The first step, it seems to me, is to recognize and identify some of the implicit contradictions whereby we're less likely, me and you, to get trapped in them. The first potential contradiction grows out of the various roles the minister is asked to assume. Get clear on what you really want, and then express it to me, to my successor, but also to yourselves. Do you want me, do you want your next settled minister to be a prophet, a scholar, a comforter, a friend, a toastmaster, an administrator, a PR man, a hipster, or an old salt? Probably, if you're like just about every other church, you want all of these things. Well, good luck. Since that's impossible, just be attentive to when your minister is wearing which hat. And talk to him or her, talk to me, about which hat you want the minister to wear today. Take, as just one example, the prophet role. Churches say they want to be challenged, to be inspired and motivated to new heights, new levels of social action and personal growth. But the truth is that most of the time, we don't want to be challenged all that much. We want to be patted on the back. We want the minister's spiritual blessing on our all-too-conventional lifestyles and social complacency. We want to be affirmed and supported in our social and psychological ruts. Now, actually, that's okay. I mean, that's a natural human need. We're tired. We get home at the end of the day. It's okay, but many of us tend to think in terms of the 60s civil rights and anti-war movements and to forget that, by and large, the church, along with the university, is a great supporter, a bulwark, really, a foundation of the status quo. And the Unitarian Universalist Church is not that much of an exception. Even in the 60s, most of our churches were conservative, and most Unitarian Universalist churches were pretty staid. It's true. I mean, almost a third of our ministers went to Selma. Two-thirds did not. Churches, even UU churches, are kind of intrinsically conservative organizations. In the late 40s and early 50s, when A. Powell Davies, of All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C., was preaching to four members of the Supreme Court every Sunday, he was not preaching revolution. And ministers or professors that do, like Jesus or Socrates, tend to get in hot water, to say the least. Consider, many of the denominational heroes we celebrate today had, when they were working, one heck of a time. Ralph Waldo Emerson resigned from the ministry under pressure. Olympia Brown was forced out of her own pulpit in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Theodore Parker was shunned for years by nearly all of his colleagues. Keep in mind, religion is an irritant, not a salve. The prophetic message, whether East or West, activist or mystical, from Jeremiah Wright to Stephen Fritchman to Sister Simone Campbell, the nun on the bus who was the Ware lecturer at the recent General Assembly in Rhode Island. The prophetic message of all three of these and others puts the lie to complacency. And what's funny about all this, a contradiction, is that at the same time religion is an irritant, the minister is called upon to be a healer and physician, to balm our weary souls and help us go forth and carry on. Say something spiritual, I am forever hearing. Remind me of the grace that abounds. Give me a glimpse of infinity. But don't run over 20 minutes. Almost more than members want to be challenged, they want to be touched, to be reminded of the beauty all around them, of the meaning, the deep meaning in our families, in our capacity to take pride in good work, to be inspired and fortified, to keep at it, to keep on keeping on, as Marvin Gaye once put it, for another week. And most of all, we want to feel, for a moment, our souls, the rush of discovery, of awe, amazement, or wonder, the rekindling of affection, and a sense of thankfulness or gratitude. One learns over time how to do these things, but it's never easy. The key, I think, for me anyway, a key, is humility. There's a lot of beauty and wonder and meaning in the world, but one has to get off their high horse before she or he can easily see it. As the Unitarian Henry David Thoreau wrote in Walden, humility, like darkness, reveals great lights. And here we come upon another contradiction woven into the fabric of ministry. By helping us come back to our senses, people can begin thinking that the minister herself or himself is someone special. We may be good at what we do, and a lot of us are, actually, but it's not really how brilliant or hardworking or creative the minister is. It's our ability to share with lay members of the church our thoughts and feelings and to hear the same from them, to be in full-hearted and open-minded dialogue. At the core of our Unitarian Universalist tradition is the idea, the mythic idea, really, of covenant. Like the words you repeat every Sunday, we just did here in the order of service, where you covenant to be in love, to be loving with one another and truth seeking and of service. Covenants affirm our commitment to be in an ongoing conversation with one another, to search together for the sacred, the really real. The minister in our tradition is not supposed to tell congregants how to think or how to feel, but to challenge and encourage them to think and to feel. Covenant is based on dialectic, truth-seeking, as opposed to heuristics, debate. Ideally, this is what most of our congregational efforts are about, truth-seeking. Too many of our day-to-day conversations, mine too, are unfortunately heuristic, as the same root as error. We know that we're in an heuristic conversation whenever we find ourselves framing an answer while our interlocutor is still talking. You know how you do that? You're talking to somebody and you're figuring out you're not being present to them and you're not being present to yourself. You're not in dialectic. You're in an heuristic dialogue. Dialectic, on the other hand, happens a la Socrates whenever we admit to our uncertainty and go searching together. Unitarian Universalism in this way can sometimes feel like my 10th grade biology class. Whenever one of us asked Mr. Chadbourne a question, instead of simply answering, he'd ask, "How would you formulate an experiment to figure that out?" His method could be very wearisome, but he taught us how to think and how to learn. I'm reminded of a UU congregation in Illinois I once heard about with a sign over the sanctuary door that reads, "Here, all your answers are questioned." Well, okay then. So there are no answers. But at least we can expect, even if the world itself is never ceasing open-ended flux, at least we can expect our minister to be solid and dependable, somebody we can count on, rely on, and know where they stand. So here we have another contradiction, perhaps the most difficult one to get beyond, that is to transcend and turn into a creative contrast. For if the world, as modern physicists tell us, is in constantly transforming open-ended flux, then we, too, if we are to be truly integral and whole in the world, must recognize ourselves as being in flux, too. And yet the world of social institutions and organization finds this almost impossible to accept. The open, changing person is threatening. We want to know what we can expect from our leaders, not always have to be responding to something new. It was when Jesus did not play to the expectations of his followers that they allowed him to be killed. And in just the same way, political and academic mavericks tend to be platooned or marginalized, while dependable, that is, predictable people, the kind who take a position and don't change it for 40 years, go far. People like the politician Jesse Helms or the behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner, they develop a whole political faction or philosophical academic school behind them. The rub, the contradiction, is that this whole dependably consistent thing is essentially ego or mask, which is precisely the problem. To grow spiritually and psychologically and together as a community, we have to learn how and become open enough to take our masks off. And yet, too often, the whole religious enterprise is set up to keep our masks on. I often lament that longtime church members will suddenly go through a crisis, a divorce, a loss of a job, a disfiguring or disabling illness. And then, when they most need a loving and non-judgmental support community, stop coming to church out of embarrassment or shame at the very time they are most in need. But if members have difficulty taking off their masks, how more threatening it is for the minister. How much easier it is to stay behind the pulpit. It's kind of like a barrier. You can hide out. And to keep one's robe on. Make no mistake about it. All ministers, your next minister included, are only human. We can only lead with our strengths and our weaknesses. Our faith, Unitarian Universalism, is centered upon two great heresies. I mean, it's ironic that we don't have a doctrine, really, and yet our name is after two theological heresies. First, the Unitarian heresy, that all is one. Not three, not four, not two, not good and evil, two, one. It's all interconnected, the interdependent web. And second, universalism, that we're all saved the way we are. The gig is up. Just accept it. Accept yourself. Accept each other with all of our foibles. Celebrate those foibles and help people be as healthy and happy as they can. Thus can we be open and honest with each other. We don't have to wear masks at all. This is nothing to be embarrassed or afraid of. Indeed, it is our greatest asset, our profoundest truth. Here, in this sanctuary, this place of art and music and self-discovery and foremost of search, here among friends and soon to be friends, here we can get off our high horses, take off our masks, offer one another our hands and hearts, and enter into the dialectic of beloved community. For in reality, true ministry is a relationship between an open, loving congregation and a learning, growing, learning to love pastor. A vital ministry emerges between a congregation and its minister, or doesn't. I've been in the professional ministry now for 35 years. Come December 2nd will be the 35th anniversary of my ordination. And I've come to know a lot of ministers across the board, whatever their style, their theology, their gender or orientation. We Unitarian Universalists have a remarkably talented and able group of women and men out there in our ministry. Some of my colleagues have truly great capacities. And though I haven't known any of them, I'd be inclined to include your former ministers, John, Dory, and Roy Okert, in their number. Committed and loving human beings doing the best they can. But none of us is perfect or without a flaw. Certainly I am not, any more than anyone. So please don't look to me for perfection. Look to me for a relationship. A relationship nurtured by mutual humility and openness to change, and by openness to each other's weaknesses as well as our strengths, so that we can grow together in the art and practice of ministry. This is my prayer. Amen. Shalom. Namaste.